If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
And I'm Karen Greenberg.
And welcome to another edition of the Spy Talk podcast. Well, interesting week. We got a pending war with Iran. We got a new friction with Cuba. We got stuck Ukraine talks because the administration seems to be backing Russia's vision of what peace means in Ukraine. We got the FBI and Kash Patel firing the 10 agents who worked on the case of the classified documents that Trump had amassed in Mar-a-Lago. So, what do you want to talk about first? Mike, Karen, jump in.
Let's talk about Cuba. I want to talk about those boats in Cuba, which the boat, that the speedboat that got into a firefight, a lethal firefight with the Cuban authorities. They were in Cuban territorial waters. And now both the Cubans and the Americans are saying they are doing an investigation into it. And it just seems to me, just lying on the horizon, it seems like a nothing burger. And on the other hand, is it a nothing burger? And nobody's willing to really put my mind at ease about this. So what do you guys think?
Well, Rubio, I got to interject here before
thank you,
Mike Lazin. Rubio said, gee, it's just outrageous that there's like an open firefight on open seas. You know, I mean, here we are whacking drug boats day after day. So I don't know what to make of it, frankly. It's too early to say. They were members of a group, these Cubans, Miami-based Cubans, and there's always Miami-based Cubans scheming to do something inside of Cuba. They've been doing it for many, many decades, 50 years. So this seems like just more of the same. Mike?
So the Cubans put out the names of the people they thought they had killed, and at least one of them is apparently living in Miami, wasn't on the boat at all.
I'm not
quite sure what to make of that. But look, there's no question that Cuba is, you know, tensions with Cuba have been ratcheting up. The Cuban economy is in desperate shape. People are leaving in droves. There's no fuel. There's lines for food. It's really bad. Now, there's an alternative way of looking at this, or theoretically. Hypothetically speaking, anyway, we do know that the Trump administration has been conducting behind-the-scenes negotiations with the Cubans. The Cubans realize they're in a really bad shape, worse than the Iranians. We'll be talking about them shortly. There may be some talks with people in the regime who are willing to make concessions, like releasing political prisoners, like, you know, introducing some free market reforms, like dropping some of the anti-US rhetoric. That may be what's on the table. And if so, we know what has happened in the past when there are efforts to improve US-Cuba relations. Hardliners in Cuba step up to the plate and try to sabotage it. And it is entirely possible that this whole drug boat thing is something done by the Cuban security services, the hardliners, who are trying to disrupt and make sure there is no accommodation.
Drug boat? I don't think this was
I'm sorry. The boat that the Cubans were
easily
whatever
confused.
We call it. Yeah.
Anyway,
I just throw that out there as one possible scenario.
I mean, that's absolutely possible because they've been doing this for many, many years, trying to sabotage any movement toward some peaceful arrangement with Cuba.
Right.
Obama, it seems like ancient history that Obama opened up relations with Cuba and those were sailing along nicely. And of course, Trump administration.
It is ancient history.
Yeah, now it seems
barely
like it.
Remembered.
Let's talk about Ukraine. A bloody stalemate is a kind way of putting it. They had talks again in Geneva. Witkoff and Kushner, the real estate dealers who are leading the negotiations with Iran, jumped over to the negotiations with Russia and Ukraine. And they seem to be following, as many observers have pointed out, they seem to be on Russia's side, trying to pressure Ukraine into a settlement, a land for peace settlement. Ukraine, rightly, in my view, says that's just a step. The Russians want all of Ukraine and never going to stop until they take it all. So the Ukrainians are enduring, just suffering the worst of blows. There was another massive air raid overnight. More civilians being killed, more power stations being knocked offline in the middle of this bitterly cold winter. And the brave Ukrainians are putting on with it. I read a very moving story today about every day at 10 a.m. across Ukraine, people stop for a minute in silence. They stop on the subways. They stop walking down the streets. They stop in a market. They stop and stand in silence for 1 minute, the entire country. Keir Starmer, UK Prime Minister, who said, we got to stop this narrative that Russia is winning, however, because every day that the Ukrainians stall the Russians is a win for Ukraine, and the Europeans seem to be ramping up their aid pretty quickly and firmly to Ukraine.
Well, the part of that critique that runs up to reality is nobody has come up with a strategic path to evict the Russians from the territory they already hold in Ukraine. We're not going to send in U.S. troops, and the Europeans are not going to send in their troops, and the Ukrainian troops have been unable to do it. Now, as righteous as their cause is, at some point you have to look at what's practical and what's real. And, some sort of negotiated end is probably the only way to get there. And
as all wars end with negotiations, but what are the terms?
But what's changed since the very, very beginning of this war? The issues are still the same. Are you going to give up? It hasn't changed. It doesn't seem to have any nuance. It's just like, this is the stalemate that is at the base of this war. And it, no matter how many negotiations, there's been doesn't seem to be wiggle room. Do you see it otherwise?
No, I don't. Only if, Trump were defeated at the polls, he left, we had an administration that came in and said, we're going in to Ukraine, not with troops, but we're going to really bolster their air defenses and provide them with long-range missiles. So it's certainly not going to happen under the Trump administration, and they got three long years
to go. Yeah, but look, I mean, the Biden folks didn't do that. They didn't want to escalate the war.
No, I
can't imagine there's going to be another American administration that's going to be eager to ramp up the war in Ukraine. Yeah. That sounds exactly where the American population is not.
Yeah.
So
it's just like, has there been a plan on the table that you've seen that is some, a little bit of giving up on one side, a little bit of giving up on the other side, or that's just off the table, that's not possible?
Only come when one side
caves.
Gets a significant military advantage over the other, where the other side says, we quit. The United States, that's what happened to the United States in Vietnam. We thought we'd never quit Vietnam until the communists, aided by the U.S. Congress, saying, we don't want this going on anymore. Too many casualties. We're suffering too much. It's politically undefendable. the United States gave up and went into negotiations with the North Vietnamese. So right now it's a stalemate, a bloody, bloody stalemate. And until one side gets a hand over the other, it's not going to change. That's been the history of war since the beginning of wars.
Well, meanwhile, we may be about to start a new war in Iran. Yeah,
with Iran. Be,
yes.
And Xi Jinping has been unnervingly quiet about Taiwan in the last few days. I'm very nervous about Taiwan and China at this point. And Xi Jinping has to be salivating at the sight of two U.S. carrier groups and 150 U.S. warplanes tied up with Iran.
Do you buy all of these expressions of anxiety about the United States not having any more the amount of weaponry, ships, et cetera, that they need for all of these different conflicts that we're thinking about, including Iran?
Well, we're going to talk about that with our terrific guest today, John Alterman, who was a longtime State Department official, a Middle East specialist, who's also done time as an advisor to the Chief of Naval Operations, a highly respected guy who's known and dealt with Iranians for some 30 years. He's our featured guest today, and we're really looking forward to that very lively conversation. Before we get out of this, we have to mention, Tulsi Gabbard. We'll try to avoid her. Because she so easily comes to mind as one of the chief clowns of the national security apparatus of this administration. But it's Kash Patel, who's been stealing the spotlight this week with his antics, beer-swigging antics in Italy. And now we've learned that he's fired 10 of the FBI agents who dealt with the Trump case of, stashing classified documents at Mar-a-Lago. He just fired them. I suspect it's going to be a number of lawsuits out of that. But in the meantime, the retribution campaign goes on.
I think we should focus more on the video of Kash Patel in the men's locker room at the Olympics. I mean, acting like a frat boy, guzzling beer, just looking completely ridiculous.
Would you look that different than Robert Kennedy Jr.? Showing off his body and, working out, or
him
Pete Hegseth
in the sauna.
Or Pete We're Hegseth. Not, I mean, what's yeah. going on?
Yeah. It's well, disgusting. No, the issue with Patel is he does seem to use FBI aircraft, which he's required to take whenever he travels, for a lot of trips that certainly have a large personal component, which this did. Now,
girlfriend.
I realize that he did have some official meetings in Milan while he was there.
Yeah, but it's official meetings in Nashville.
We did a piece and had as our guest Ron Kessler a few months ago, who actually had uncovered the overseas travel of Bill Sessions for personal purposes. And, there was an inspector general investigation into that. And they did things like, okay, what's this official business you say you were there for? When did that come up? Who proposed that? Were you invited or did you invite yourself? I mean, those are the kind of questions you would ask to determine whether was this really an official visit.
They're not going to be asked. Who's going to ask Kash Patel? This is a guy who has spent a lot of time reading the Epstein files, and he's not going to get fired.
Yeah.
He's got a pistol in the back of his pocket. He'll go on and on. God knows why Kristi Noem is still there, but whatever. Anyway, so let's turn our attention back to Iran, which is really the major issue among major issues at the moment. Let's hear a little bit of what President Trump had to say about Iran in the State of the Union speech.
After Midnight Hammer, they were warned to make no future attempts to rebuild their weapons program, and in particular, nuclear weapons. Yet they continue starting it all over. We wiped it out, and they want to start all over again, and are at this moment again pursuing their sinister ambitions. We are in negotiations with them. They want to make a deal, but we haven't heard those secret words. We will never have a nuclear weapon. My preference is to solve this problem through
diplomacy. But one thing is certain, I will never allow the world's number one sponsor of terror, which they are by far, to have a nuclear weapon.
Well, what I heard is that Trump spent so little time talking about Iran, it's like he wanted the whole thing to just go away. I mean, he spent a lot more time on other issues, his usual braggadocio and his sort of game show introduction of guests, you know, come on down. But we have a terrific guest, John Alterman. As I mentioned before, he's a former State Department Middle East expert. He also was on an advisory committee to the Chief of Naval Operations. He has met with Iranians many times over 30 years, and we have him on the show today, and he is a great guest. So without further ado, here we go with our interview with John Alterman.
Do your knees make you feel older than you are? You're out here trying to have a hot girl summer at 35. You're on dating apps. You're saying yes to spontaneous trips. Maybe you're rediscovering your flexibility, and your knees are like, actually, we'd like to quit. The IncrediWear Infrared Knee Sleeve uses fabric tech designed to increase blood flow and help reduce pain and speed recovery, so your knees can actually keep up with your life. It's like giving your body the support it already wants while it heals, just without all the extra pain and drama. Wear it to the gym. Wear it on a date. Wear it while you're doing things I cannot say on this podcast. It's comfortable, breathable, and works 24/7. Go to freesocks.com and grab the IncrediWear knee sleeve and a free pair of socks with purchase. That's freesox.com. Because if something's going to give out, let it be him, not your knees.
John Alterman, welcome to Spy Talk. Let me ask you, would it be fair to say that Trump would be greatly relieved if he could get back to the same deal that President Obama negotiated with Iran back in 2015, which capped uranium enrichment at 3.5%? Or is his seeming insistence that Iran give up the missiles, is that going to scuttle the talks and trigger a war? Because I can't see the Iranians accepting that. Can you?
I don't think the Iranians will accept it. He may think the Iranians might accept it, or there are certain conditions under which they'd accept it. But it seems to me that first, the Iranians are very interested in negotiating for the sake of negotiating, because when they're negotiating, they're in play. And when they're not negotiating, they're being isolated. So I think the Iranians are interested in having a negotiation, but they're also not interested in losing their ability to have a negotiation. In many ways, the nuclear program has been the goose that lays the golden egg. It is a way, when they want to talk to the world, that the world comes and says, we need to have a conversation. Then the Iranians are in a position to extract some sort of concession one way or the other. You know, one of the interesting questions is, what does success look like for the Iranians? And I think for a lot of Americans, success would be the Iranians end their hostile relations with the rest of the world. Isn't that really what they want? And in fact, when I've talked to Iranians, and I've been talking to Iranians for 30 years about this issue set, I think the conclusion of the leadership is there's no way to get rid of the world's hostility, and particularly America's hostility. Mm. So if that's the constant, then the only thing you can do is build up some tools that you can modulate that hostility. And when you want to relieve it, there are things you can do. And when you want to raise it, there are things you can do. And I think the Iranians are looking for agency in a world where they feel relatively weak and isolated, and they're looking for tools.
Let me just break down one of the points you made. What do you really mean when you say there's no way that nothing they could do to get rid of the world's hostility? They could, if they renounced pursuit of a nuclear weapon or their enrichment program, if they proclaimed that they would stop covert operations against the West, what could they do? And if they did it, would lessen the hostility against them?
No, lessening the hostility, I think they think they can do. Although arguably that's exactly what President Rouhani tried to do. And the narrative in Iran is Rouhani gave up a lot and never got the economic benefits for the Iranian people that the JCPOA was intended to deliver, was promised to deliver. I think when I've spoken to Iranians, and certainly in the last 10 years, they've been consistent in saying that rather than relieve the hostility, it makes Iran weaker and more vulnerable, where the United States and its allies and partners will continue to weaken and weaken and weaken the government of Iran until they've defeated the Iranian government, the Iranian people, made them a vassal. You know, if you're looking for an analogy, and it's not a perfect one, but you could say Yasser Arafat pledged that he would give up violent struggle against the Israelis, and you continue to see Israel acting violently against Palestinians. And while the Israelis say, well, the Palestinians are still fighting us, I think a lot of Palestinians will say Arafat giving up armed struggle neither gave us a state nor gave us security. And I think certainly Iranians, who are going to be very sympathetic to that viewpoint, say we can't become defenseless. So you need to have at least the threat of ballistic missiles. You need to have at least the possibility of a nuclear program. You need this sort of forward positioning of proxy forces, because otherwise the United States and Israel will walk all over us and they'll dismantle everything.
John, I have to push back on your account of Arafat and giving up armed struggle. Yeah, and then he rejected a Palestinian state and launched the Second Intifada. That's why the Israelis responded with violence.
I'm not saying I agree with it. Okay. I'm saying that's the way that they see it. Right?
Well, yeah, they also whip up crowds saying death to America and death to the Zionist entity. That might be an explanation for why the rest of the world is hostile to the regime.
But I'll tell you an interesting story. Elaine Shalino, longtime New York Times reporter, was in Iran, I think was on the plane back with Khomeini in 79. She was in Iran, I think it was 2000, not sure what year it was. There was an uprising in the streets, very, very chaotic situation. She was there trying not to look American, very unsure where she could go, what she could do. And she said she didn't feel secure until she turned on the TV and saw crowds chanting death to America, because she said, I know this play. I know the behavior. It's orchestrated by this. It's all within bounds. This is play acting. It's not real. And it wasn't until she saw death to America that she felt she was personally secure. Now, that's her account of it. How many Iranians really think about death to America? How many Iranians say, I want to visit America? I want to emigrate to America? I think there are probably more who want to come than want to hate America. But it's part of this thing. I mean, the Iranians have backed themselves into a corner where you're quite right. It is easy to find evidence of Iranian hostility. And they come and they say, well, we don't really mean it. You have to give us assurances. They want to be in this negotiation. But I think one of the things that condemns the negotiations to failure is they can't really imagine success at the end of the day. They think it's almost like being in purgatory. And success means they're continuing to negotiate from this period of, or from this position of isolation and hostility, and they can't see a way out of that. Rouhani, who I think was one of the pragmatists in the Iranian system, but one who had the trust of the security services, argued, we can't do anything about the fact of American hostility, but the degree of American hostility is counterproductive to our interests. So what we have to do is not find a way to eliminate the hostility. We have to find a way to reduce it. And again, that the Iranian narrative is, we tried to do that, and then Trump walked away from the JCPOA. And it demonstrates that the Americans never wanted to be engaged in a constructive relationship with us. They wanted to destroy us. And if it's all about self-preservation, the only thing you can do is make sure you still have arrows in your quiver to continue to fight. I'm not saying it's right, but I'm saying I think that's the way the leadership sees the task of negotiations and sees the prospect of American attacks and potentially coming. So
one of the puzzling things about this is why now? What's driven us to the point where we might be going to war at the moment? We don't know exactly what the goal, what the mission would be. And, you know, Trump's kind of threw something out there during the State of the Union that didn't get a lot of attention, but it caught my ear. He said, talking about the Iranians, they've already developed missiles that can threaten Europe and our bases overseas, and they're working to build missiles that will soon reach the United States of America. Now, the National Intelligence Council had done a report last year that said they're years away from an ICBM to reach America. Is there some new intelligence here that we haven't seen before, don't know about? Or is this a replay of some of the exaggerations and overstatements made during the run-up to the Iraq?
Well, in my first and only trip to Iran in 2000, I came back and I was speaking to an AIPAC group.
AIPAC?
The American Israel Public Affairs Committee, and somebody said, well, when can Iran reach the United States with a nuclear weapon? And I said, I don't see any near-term prospect of that. And the lobbyist from AIPAC came up afterward and said, we're telling people that's in the next year. So I've been hearing the Iranians are a year away from being able to strike the United States with missiles for 25 years. At some point, that may be true. I don't have any evidence that it's true now, but you know, to me, the Iranian weapon is they have a whole array of tools, and they're not afraid of getting hit. And I think our calculus is countries look at a massive strike and they say, how do we avoid that? And the Iranians look at a massive strike and they say, okay, business as usual. How do we think past it? And how do we either, you know, do a sort of Muhammad Ali rope-a-dope and sort of get the Americans tired out? The Americans were only off the coast of Yemen for 31 days trying to attack the Houthis. And we said, we're not doing a long drawn out thing. Can you draw the Americans where they feel they have to send troops in? And then you have a sort of Afghanistan kind of a war of attrition. They certainly helped Iraqis do that to us when we were in Iraq and did some themselves, I'm sure. But I think the Iranians are thinking past this in a way that a lot of people in the administration say, we'll give them a clear choice and they'll fold. They see folding as surrendering, which weakens them. And instead they're looking at, okay, so 6 months from now, where do we want to be? And how do we demonstrate, look, we survived this American onslaught, we're the ones who defied Donald Trump. And how do we use that to further secure ourselves and be in this bargaining position again? Because they don't see a way out of bargaining for their survival. I think they think that's just their fate in the world.
So you, a couple of things here. You told this story as if the, you know, instigator in this current chapter is Iran. But what about the United States? What isn't it the United States that began this whole, you know, we're going to go after Iran, we're going to challenge their nuclear buildup, we're going to make these accusations about everything from nuclear to ballistic missiles. So what, how did this happen? I mean, you look at the national security strategy, Iran's not part of what they're focused on. It's not in the picture they're presenting. What is in it for, as you see it, for this administration to have decided this is going to be their focus right now?
So I think a couple of things. One was the brutal put down of the uprising that I think got people talking about it in a different way. I think the Israelis, who have a whole different set of preferences than the United States, are involved. I think the Gulf Arabs are very, very concerned about, you know, if you remember going to the dolphin show at the aquarium, they're concerned about being in the splash zone. They are the nearby targets. And not only in terms of missiles, but in terms of Iranian populations that they think are infiltrated by Iranian intelligence in, whether it's the UAE or Bahrain or Kuwait or elsewhere. So there's a real concern in the Gulf that this could spill over to them. The Israeli idea is we need to keep pounding the Iranians, and until they cry uncle, we will hit them every 6 months if it takes. So this is, you know, the Israeli view of Gaza for many years was mowing the grass. You just go in and you destroy things every few years, take down capabilities, and just do it over and over and over again. And Israelis, certainly Israeli officials, have said to me, that's what we have to do with Iran. When we see they have capability, we'll just go in and hit them again. We'll go in and hit them again. And from an Israeli perspective, the U.S. has a lot of capabilities Israel doesn't have. Israel has probably, from what I understand, better intelligence on many things. And they have people on the ground that the U.S. doesn't have. But they don't have the sort of bunker buster armaments or the placement to have planes take off and deliver munitions. So I think from an Israeli perspective, the war in June was a marvelous example of how Israel could set the table. The U.S. uses its unique capabilities to destroy things that advance Israeli national security. And when you have to do it again, you have to do it again. And I think that's what, in many ways, that's what the Netanyahu government is looking for right now.
John, let me ask you about a baseline fact here. It is your belief, after all these years of experience, you've met with Iranians for 30 years, are they trying to build a nuclear weapon?
I think they're trying to maintain a nuclear option.
You mean getting close to getting up to 60% enrichment?
Well, they've gone way beyond 60%.
And they can jump, they can race to 90% in a matter of weeks. Is that what you mean?
So to have a nuclear device, you need something to detonate, and you need a delivery system. And the challenge of the delivery system is when you fire a weapon, there's a lot of what the technical term is shake and bake. There's a lot of heat and vibration. And the horrible thing is when you launch a nuclear weapon and it detonates on the launch pad because there's too much heat and vibration at the takeoff. That would be very bad.
That's a bad day.
That's a bad thing. I think they look at the North Koreans and they say, nobody's attacked the North Koreans since they demonstrated a nuclear capability where they have delivery systems. All
so it's just a long way around saying, yes, they have an intent to get a couple of weeks away from a nuclear weapon.
I think they want to maintain the option. Whether they actually want to build a weapon, I'm not. Well, I think part of the challenge, and it's become a larger challenge in recent years, especially after June, I'm not sure they have confidence that the Israelis haven't really penetrated their entire nuclear apparatus and wouldn't have a lot of notice of that happening. So again, to me, there's something they love about being able to turn the dial up or down on relations with the world over the nuclear program. Because in many ways, the worst case scenario is you are poor and isolated and everybody ignores you and you can't do anything about it. Then you're totally powerless. And I think they see the nuclear program as a relatively cheap way to get the world's attention when they want the world's attention. You could say it's totally counterproductive because it's negative attention. Yes, but I think that's the strategy. For better or worse.
So there's a few things we haven't talked about so far, and one is the protests. When I asked before what's been driving this, the brutal suppression and the killing of thousands of protesters who want a change in this regime. And I think that's what brought Trump into it originally, right? He was talking about, you know, hang on, we're going to come help you, when he tweeted when the protests were at their peak, which was really a way of signaling regime change. So give us your thoughts on whether it's possible. You keep giving us the Iranian perspective, but the Iranian people's perspective might be quite different than what the leadership's perspective is. And the people's perspective is, we want these people gone.
Let me augment Mike's question. A former CIA officer who specialized in Iran, Mark Fowler, wrote a very interesting op-ed in the Washington Post last week or early this week saying, forget about attacking all the military stuff. We should be supporting these students with communication devices, among other things.
Which apparently we are. Starlink, I think, has been.
And we sent several thousand Starlink in.
Yeah.
We've given them access to Tor and some browsers and try to give Iranians the ability to communicate without being surveilled by a pervasive surveillance state. I think that the question you have is, do you want to weaken the Iranian government or you don't want to defeat the Iranian government? My instinct is we should be looking to weaken the Iranian government over time. I don't see a coherent opposition during the Women Life Freedom demonstrations. What I heard from people on the ground and people who spoke to people on the ground was it was almost like a postmodern protest. It was performative, but not organized in any way. One of the challenges in a police state is how do you organize and have a sort of infrastructure that can take power the same way that Ahmed al-Shara in Syria had the area right in around Idlib and was able to build an apparatus and communications and leadership skills and all those kinds of things. There's no opposition based in a neighboring country. There doesn't seem to be a lot of internal infrastructure. I don't think the Crown Prince, the Shah's son, has a huge amount of legitimacy on the ground. I don't think anybody has a lot of legitimacy on the ground. People want to vote no, but they're not sure what they want to vote yes for. And if you look at, and this will be offensive to any Iranian listeners you have, because comparing Iranians to Arabs is always offensive to Iranian listeners. But, you know, if you look at the Arab Spring, if you look at a place like Egypt, it was the inability to have an organized opposition that led to the failure of all of the democratic movements and the return of military rule or something like it throughout the Arab world.
John, I just have to say we have to step away for just a short minute for our generous sponsors to say a word. Okay, we're back.
John, can I ask you a question? You know, do you remember the Soleimani strike, the killing of Soleimani?
I do.
And one of the reports that came out.
The IRGC leader.
Yes. And the reports that came out afterwards were that when the Trump administration talked about conducting this strike, they decided that there wouldn't be much response from Iran. They made that calculation, and they turned out to be pretty accurate, although the Iranians said, we'll do it in our own place, our own time. But they turned out to be essentially right. Do you have any information about what they're calculating now about should a strike of any sort take place and what they're anticipating or not anticipating in terms of a response, either from Iran or from others outside Iran? Because, you know, they're proxy actors.
Right. I mean, what they're telegraphing is we have lots of options and we will use them. What they would actually do is unclear. After the June strikes, they telegraphed exactly what they would do. So there were no casualties. I think at this point, it's hard to think the U.S. strategy isn't to pose an existential threat to the regime, right? It's not about taking people out. It is about ending the regime. And I think that prompts the Iranians to think more creatively about how to really demonstrate their ability to hurt others, whether it's an issue of attacking shipping, attacking American troops, attacking allied troops, attacking American facilities. You know, there's a report today.
Shutting off the Gulf.
Shutting off the Gulf will be attacking shipping, which they can do either through mining, and they did something with limpet mines earlier. You know, they had the attack in 2019 at Abqaiq and Khurais in Saudi Arabia, where they used a lot of drones. It's what Norm Rule, the former national issue manager for Iran at CIA, calls implausible deniability. And there are lots of things they could do, plus the whole issue of proxies, plus the whole issue of terrorist attacks against soft targets. How much they have prepared, how much they feel they have like lined up and waiting, how long it takes to prepare something like that, I don't know. But it's hard for me, if they feel they're going down in a serious way, it's hard for me to imagine they wouldn't, A, try to go down fighting, and B, try to go down in such a way that got the Americans to think twice about the wisdom of this, to get the American public to say, what are you really doing? I mean, the Iranians have a fairly sophisticated understanding of the United States. A lot of the people on the negotiating team have lived in the United States. They have kids in the United States. You know, our press is open. They understand much more about us than we understand about them. And they will try to weaponize it. How successful they'll be, unclear. Again, you have the whole issue of maybe Israel starts this. Is it different if it looks like the U.S. is defending Israel? If American soldiers die defending Israel, how does that change a conversation in the United States? I think they're thinking through all these things in a fairly deliberate way, with an idea of how do we make sure that 6 months from now, we're still trying to figure out how we secure the country.
So given where we are now, and I should point out, we're taping this on Thursday afternoon. The latest round of negotiations in Geneva have wrapped up. It's not clear how much progress has been made, but I believe the minister from Oman, who's helping to preside over this, said there's going to be another round of next week. So it doesn't look like...
Technical talks next week.
Okay.
I don't think that tells you anything about whether the U.S. might attack. There was a... The U.S. attacked when there was an impending Witkoff meeting before.
Okay. So we shouldn't take too much comfort from that we're not going to be at war tomorrow. But look, given where we are, the Iranians say they're not going to give up enrichment. And they have no intention of giving up what we consider malign activity in the region. And they're not going to do anything about their ballistic missile system, and we've got all these assets in the region. What do you think is going to happen? What do you think should the administration do at this point?
Again, I think we are better off trying to weaken Iran rather than defeat Iran.
How so? How do we weaken them?
Well, you know, part of it's working with partners and allies to continue to isolate their economy
So that means no agreement and no sanctions relief, right? We shouldn't even be negotiating if what you're saying is our goal should simply be to weaken them. Because the goal of negotiations is sanctions relief for the Iranians. That strengthens them.
Although it's interesting that that's almost been nowhere in the U.S. discussion about the negotiations. And there's been some talk, there was reporting, I think, in the Financial Times about how the Iranians are promising entry to oil and mineral exploitation. And there have been stories that I've seen about the U.S. negotiating team dangling all kinds of money to the Iranians on the other side. Whether any of that is meaningful, whether anybody means any of it, I don't really know. But I think I feel strongly the Iranian goal is not to resolve this. It is to be in negotiations over it. And the U.S. goal, maybe we should talk to the Iranians some to try to shape their behavior to a small degree, but I think the strategy should be to isolate and weaken a completely failing regime that has a big problem with brain drain, that has an economy that's really falling apart. And I think that is working. The Iranian currency is the most worthless currency in the world. Iranians are up in arms. I think that takes time to work itself through. We should be thinking about what kinds of other Iranians we can be engaging with. We should be seeing if there are ways potentially to help an opposition. Although, frankly, our track record of helping external oppositions in Syria, in Iraq, and elsewhere is poor. And I think we should have very, very limited expectations of how quickly or how effectively that would be. But it seems to me that that is much more likely in the long run to meet American needs than essentially having a war of choice with a government that welcomes being in a war and thinks it can win a war by not losing.
Well, let me ask you this, John. The toilets are clocked up on the Truman.
On the Ford.
On the Ford. Yeah, that makes more sense.
You should explain that a little bit, Jeff, because so it is an important part of the military equation.
Well, let me just move on to the central question. How long?
it's our newest aircraft carrier.
Talk about shit happens.
It's our newest aircraft carrier that the plumbing system doesn't work very well. I'm told there's a 45-minute wait for bathrooms. They have been at sea for 11 months. They moved from the Caribbean, from off Venezuela, to the Eastern Med. And this is, I think, the longest deployment of an aircraft carrier perhaps ever.
And didn't they drop anchor someplace to let the sailors get off and go take a dump? I mean, this is like pulling off the Jersey Turnpike.
All right, you guys, I'm going to turn this back to something serious
Let me ask you a question. John, you served on an advisory commission to the Chief of Naval Operations for years. Do you have any guesses on how long this position can be sustained, two carrier groups, 150 warplanes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, some of which, by the way, are now based in Israel. How long can this go on from a naval point of view, do you guess?
Look, I mean, it's expensive. That's one thing.
Okay.
It's hard because the Navy has all these rotational requirements. There's maintenance of the ships. I mean, you can't do it indefinitely. We previously had two carriers off the coast of Iran, and you can do it for several months. You can't do it indefinitely. The other challenge, which I've seen much less discussion about, is in terms of the armaments, in terms of air defense systems. You know, the Iranian salvos in the past used up a lot of THAAD batteries and other kinds of things. If there's
that's a missile, just to explain, that's an air defense missile system.
There aren't so many interceptors. There's sort of these exquisite weapons that take a long time to build, and we use a lot of them. We've used a lot in Ukraine. We used a lot in previous encounters with the Iranians when they attacked Israel and, say, attacked Qatar. There's just a limited period we could fight a full-scale war.
Well, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Dan Raisin Kane, as Trump calls him, advised, according to pretty persuasive reporting, he advised Trump that there's a shortage of munitions.
Although arguably the military is always arguing they need more money, right? But that's an old story. But the reality is, you can't keep fighting these kinds of wars all over the world without replenishing your stocks. And it takes a long time to replenish the stocks. And we're lower on things than we'd want to be. And to the extent that the Pentagon is completely oriented toward potentially defending Taiwan in the event of a Chinese attack, and you can argue whether that's the case or not the case, but I think there's a real concern in the military, in the logistics people's mind, that you could spend so much energy defending Israel from Iran that you can't defend Taiwan from China. And then you really have a geopolitical shift going on in the world.
Have we given up on the idea that the president would have to go to Congress to conduct this strike that may be happening at any moment?
The War of Powers resolution has been introduced in Congress, and nobody wants to pass it.
Yes. So I'm saying, what is the – how would this play out? Is anybody talking about that in terms of presidential
Democrats
powers?
Yeah. But, I mean, it's been an awfully long time since the U.S. declared war on anybody, right?
Yes.
I don't think the president has an instinct to go to Congress, and I don't think Congress wants to weigh in on this. You know, in many ways, as we got to this point, it's, and whenever I talk to people in the White House about sort of preparing for the president, they always talk about preserving the president's optionality, right? The president wants to maintain the opportunity to make a decision at the very last moment based on whatever drives him to make the decision. But there's a real interest in not backing the president into anything. I think what the president was really hoping for, I think this is based on no actual information, but I think he actually hoped that the Israelis would do something covertly. And if it worked, he would take credit for supporting it. And if it didn't work, he'd say, this was not my job at all. That's the Israelis. I mean, what can you do? Because the reality is the president really can get dragged into a very sustained set of hostilities with the Iranians. And I think the Iranians think they can do rope-a-dope and they can win that the same way the Houthis got the president to say, well, I'm done off the coast of Yemen.
So, John, right in the middle of all this, just in the last couple of days, Defense Secretary Hegseth fired the director of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, a vice admiral named Fred Kacher, who he had just appointed to the position on December 10th, which seems like an odd thing to do if you're about to go to war. Any insight into what that's all about?
No.
Do you find it odd that the executive director of the Joint Chiefs of Staff would be fired on the verge of a potential military conflict?
They just fired the 10 FBI agents who worked on the Mar-a-Lago documents case. This is, you know,
well,
this
that case is
a hallmark of this administration. But, we have to wrap this up now.
Well, wait. Let John finish his point.
What I'm hearing is that the Pentagon is not operating according to normal functions, normal rules. Hegseth doesn't play the role in the administration that secretaries of defense normally play.
You might say.
I don't know what Dan Kane's view of this was, but I think if you're looking for things, I would be much more interested in his view of it and his relationship with this guy rather than Hegseth. That's my
According to the reporting, Dan Kane said, we have a problem of the ones that of the kind you talked about a few minutes ago, which is there's only so many missile defense systems, munitions to go around. And we've been very busy in Ukraine, et cetera. It's drawn down our stocks. And the other issue we brought up is this is going to seriously strain our relationship with other allies in the region and, of course, in Western Europe. So somebody wanted to get that out of the White House. You know, was it Dan Kane and his pals in the Pentagon? Is it somebody who found out something on the Hill? Anyway, that very sensitive conversation between the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the president of the United States, it in the Oval Office, it got out. So that tells you.
My bet's on Elbridge.
Colby,
Colby, yeah. Colby is the guy.
That's a very good bet. But let me ask you this to close out this great conversation. It could go on and on. It's really fascinating from you. David Petraeus said the other day in an interview with Foreign Policy that one of the things he'd be concerned about is what's next if you bring down the regime through military pressure and helping students and other oppositionists, you know, challenge the regime. Let's say you bring down the regime. What happens next? You've had conversations with the Iranians over 30 years, as I remarked earlier. You have any guesses?
So I think to me, the key to that question is, what do you mean by taking down the regime? If what you want to get rid of is guys with beards and turbans, it's easy to get rid of guys with beards and turbans. The repressive apparatus of Iran is run by the security services. They control the smuggling networks. They control the financial networks. They control all those things. That's all a different layer. I see them likely to retain some kind of control, whether you can find a Delcy Rodriguez among them, somebody who can claim victory because you've changed the regime. You might be able to do that, although my guess is they haven't found a lot of receptivity to that. But I think in terms of really getting rid of this entire ruling class, lock, stock, and barrel, without having any sort of really well-organized opposition with roots in the country is low. I think we saw just how difficult it was in Iraq when we had troops on the ground and we were focused and all those things, and we couldn't do it. We couldn't get the kinds of outcomes. The challenge of all of this, it seems to me, broadly, is we're trying to affect their political calculations from the air. And I think ultimately it's going to be very, very hard to accomplish our political goals from the air. I think the Iranians know that. They're hunkering down. They're thinking politically about how to undermine what we're doing. And it feels to me like we may be on the brink of the most consequential foreign policy decision of the Trump administration. The president will go into this. It would be a war of choice, and it could end up very, very poorly for him.
What amounts to a disaster for the U.S.?
Well, I think a number of things. One is if you take a big swing and you fail, you could get sucked into this. Something could happen elsewhere while we're sucked in to this. You could have a massive attack on one of our allies for which the U.S. would be blamed. I can imagine any number of things where people would say, I thought the president was getting us out of all these wars, and he's chosen a war, and it turned out badly. But I just don't think there's a way to sort of go in and do something quick and dirty. This is a regime that has been in power for 47 years. They've thought a lot about this. We keep putting negotiators who are, let's say, fresh-faced.
Oh, they're real estate dealers.
Against a negotiating team that's been doing this for decades. They know what we fall for. They know what our ticks are. They know how to pull the wool over our eyes, all these things. And I think the president thinks this is much simpler than it is. The Iranian government has a single strategic focus, and that is, how do you manage the hostility of the United States? The U.S. government has 100 strategic focuses, one of which is, how do you keep the Iranians from behaving as nastily as they do? And I think if you have one focus and you have the same people thinking about it, they've gotten very good at it, they know our moves, and it's like, you know, you're sending a football team on without having reviewed game film. I think the advantage, even though the Iranians are infinitely weaker than us, I think they have a home field advantage. They understand us better than we understand us. And I think for them, because they're so much weaker, a draw comes out as a win for them, and a draw is a huge loss for us, especially if we look like we're really trying.
Mike, Karen, anything else?
Okay. No, I think John has kind of wrapped
on
it
that
up.
Happy note.
Scary.
So many of our podcasts end on happy notes like that.
Well, I'll end on a happy note, and that's, I'm a longtime listener, first time caller. It's great to see you guys. I love what you're doing with the podcast, and I'm so happy cool. too. We're just
great. It's been great to have you. It's been a very lively talk, John. Thanks to you.
Thanks, guys.
So long.
Thank you.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses from the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk, and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
I'm Karen Greenberg.
Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to SpyTalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.